Vampires and werewolves were once considered part of the demonic realm. But nowadays, they have become the heartthrobs of adolescent girls. Pop culture is an interesting thing, isn't it? In 1942, C.S. Lewis had his famous work of fiction, The Screwtape Letters, published, which is a series of letters from a senior devil named Screwtape, written to a junior devil named Wormwood, instructing him on how to tempt a human that they refer to as the patient. In the preface of the book, C.S. Lewis wrote, "There are two equal and opposite errors into which our race can fall about the devils. One is to disbelieve in their existence. The other is to believe and feel an excessive and unhealthy interest in them. They themselves, the devils, are equally pleased by both errors." And although it's been almost 70 years since C.S. Lewis made that observation, it's as true today as it was then. People still fall into making one of these two errors concerning demons. They either deny their existence altogether, or they are infatuated with them, attributing every bad thing in their lives to demons. Many in our high-tech modern world of mobile gadgets find it hard to accept the existence of demons. If we can't see the thing, if we can't touch the thing, then the thing must not exist. But whether we believe demons exist or not doesn't change the fact that they do exist. And as C.S. Lewis pointed out, they are quite happy with us not thinking that they're real. That just makes their job easier. Peter wrote in 1 Peter 5:8, "Be self-controlled and alert. Your enemy, the devil, prowls around like a roaring lion looking for someone to devour." The Apostle Paul, in Ephesians 6:12, he wrote this. He said, "For our struggle is not against flesh and blood, but against the rulers, against the authorities, against the powers of this dark world, and against the spiritual forces of evil in the heavenly realms." This might sound strange to you, but there is a spiritual war going on right now around you, and our hearts and minds are the battleground of that war. The Greek word translated struggle in Ephesians 6:12, where it says, "For our struggle is not against flesh and blood, but against these spiritual forces of evil." That word struggle refers to hand-to-hand combat that soldiers engage in when they're fighting in a war. When God the Son entered our world in the person of Jesus Christ, all hell began to break loose in a literal sense. What might have been considered a series of skirmishes before in the spiritual realm surrounding human beings was elevated to a full-scale war on a level never seen before. You might remember that shortly after Jesus was born, King Herod, under the inspiration of demons, ordered that every male baby in the region be killed in an attempt to kill the Christ infant. But Jesus' parents fled to Egypt with the baby Jesus before Herod's men could get to them. When Jesus was out in the desert wilderness for 40 days, just before he began his public ministry, you might remember the devil tempted him again and again, trying to get him to abandon his mission. All during Jesus' public ministry, he encountered demon possession cases. The exorcising of demons was a regular part of his healing ministry. The demons would scream out through the possessed person, saying, "We know who you are, Jesus of Nazareth, the Christ, the Holy One of God." They were hoping to gain some kind of power or control over Jesus by being able to identify him. But Jesus would silence them and command them to leave the person, setting the person free. There was a big increase in demonic activity during the public ministry of Jesus. And now at the end of Jesus' life on earth, as it draws to a close, Satan is launching a full assault against him. And we're going to see some of that in the story today. You can begin making your way to John chapter 13. We'll be picking up where we left off last time. Here's the setting. It is Thursday evening. Jesus and his 12 closest disciples are in the city of Jerusalem eating the evening meal together. The disciples don't know it yet, but this is going to be their very last meal together. Later this same night, Jesus will be arrested. He'll then stand trial and be crucified the next day. The words of Jesus found in John chapter 13 through 17 are the final things that Jesus shares with his disciples before his death. When someone knows they are about to pass from this life, they often speak some of the most important words they've ever said. These final conversations that Jesus has with his disciples deserve our attention in a special way, knowing the context that they're spoken in. Last time, we read the story of Jesus taking on the role of a servant at this meal that he has with his disciples here. He got down and he washed the feet of each of his disciples. And through this act, he was doing three things that we talked about last week. First, he was expressing his special love for these men. He's poured his life into them. They have been his closest companions, and he wants them to know how much he loves them and how much he's going to miss them. The second, this act functioned as a living parable of what Jesus would be doing on a larger spiritual cosmic scale through his death for the whole human race. Even though he was God the Son, he stepped down from that high place and became a servant to our race, to humanity, dying for us, giving up his life as a sacrifice for us. And through his death, those who believe in him have the filth of their sin washed away and are made clean before God. They're made righteous before God. Third, through this act of foot washing, Jesus was setting an example for his followers of how we're to treat each other. We're to serve each other. We are to consider one another above ourselves, help each other, look out for each other, honor one another before ourselves. Well, Jesus is now continuing the same conversation with his disciples that we were looking at last time. And they're still at the table, still eating together. And in John 13, verse 18, this conversation continues. Jesus speaking, and he says, "I am not referring to all of you. I know those I have chosen, but this is to fulfill the scripture. He who shares his bread has lifted up his heel against me. I am telling you now before it happens, so that when it does happen, you will believe that I am he. I tell you the truth." Excuse me. "I tell you the truth. Whoever accepts anyone I send accepts me, and whoever accepts me accepts the one who sent me." After he said this, Jesus was troubled in spirit and testified, "I tell you the truth. One of you is going to betray me." See, couched in the middle of everything else that is going on in these final moments of Jesus' life on earth, there is a backstabbing about to take place. Judas Iscariot is going to betray Jesus. He is going to tell the Jewish authorities where and how they can arrest Jesus and then lead them to Jesus. I mentioned this before, that because of the plot by the religious leaders to kill Jesus, and because of the crowd's desire to make Jesus king and force a fight with the Romans, Jesus can no longer walk the streets of Jerusalem freely. He stays out of sight most of the time, spending most of his time with his closest disciples. And when he does make public appearances, they are carefully chosen to prevent both his premature arrest by the authorities and rioting by the crowds. So if the authorities were going to arrest Jesus, they needed to know his whereabouts when he was out of the public eye. They can't sees him when he's out in public, that would certainly create a riot. So they want to nab him when he's in privacy with his disciples. And Judas agrees to help them do that. The question is asked, well, what motivated Judas to do this? I mean, why would he betray Jesus like this? Some say that it was for the money. If so, Judas was not a very smart businessman. He sold Jesus for 30 pieces of silver, equivalent to about $60 in today's money. Surely a notorious troublemaker like Jesus would have brought more money than that. Some say he was politically motivated. Judas may have been hoping to speed along an Israelite revolt against the Romans, thinking that the arrest of Jesus would initiate a riot, perhaps, forcing Jesus to make his move and step forward as the warrior king Messiah that he and many hoped Jesus would be. Those may have been contributing factors. But we're told in the text that the betrayal of Jesus by Judas was much larger than one man's greed or delusions of power. Judas was not acting alone. He was working in concert with the spiritual forces of evil. This was a joint venture between humanity and the devil. The devil, Satan himself, was personally involved in this plot to kill Jesus. Some might ask, well, was Judas possessed by a demon, not acting under his own control and power then, being forced to do whatever the demon wanted him to do? No. Judas himself made the decision to betray Jesus. It was an act of his own will. Satan could not have entered him without him giving his permission. We aren't told when and how Judas made his pact with the devil. And I believe that he had the opportunity to turn away right up to the last minute and change his course. But he's definitely a willing participant in the betrayal of Jesus from start to finish. In verse 18, Jesus said, "I know those I have chosen." Jesus knew the hearts of every one of his disciples. He knew the strengths and weaknesses of each one. He knew the vulnerabilities of each one. He knew which of them were loyal and which were not. He knew which ones he could count on and which he could not. And you know, it's true of his followers in our day too. He knows our hearts. He knows everything about us. And that can make us feel a little vulnerable, a little exposed before him. But it's also, I think, a great comfort to know that he is someone we never have to pretend with. He loves us even though he knows everything about us. And that's amazing. Because that's not true with everyone else, is it? I mean, there are a lot of people who would definitely not love us if they knew everything about us. If you knew everything about me, you wouldn't be here listening to me today. And don't get too smart, because if I knew everything about you, I wouldn't be speaking to you today either. But we can have confidence in Jesus Christ and his love for us. He loves us even though he knows everything about us. Jesus knew Judas was going to betray him long before Judas decided to do it. In fact, the betrayal of Jesus by Judas is predicted in the prophecies hundreds of years before it happens. And it's an interesting thought for us to consider, to realize that Jesus chose Judas to be one of his closest disciples, even though he knew, even before he chose Judas, that he would betray him. He knew Judas was going to betray him the entire time they were together. Why would Jesus do that, knowing that Judas was going to stab him in the back? It's the same thing that dictated the steps of Jesus throughout his life. Everything he did was to fulfill the will of his Father in heaven. And this too was the will of his Father. It was part of his suffering as Messiah that he would be betrayed by one of his closest ones. Notice the anguish that is described in verse 21. Jesus was troubled in spirit. Even though he knew the betrayal of Judas was coming, it was not easy for him. If you've ever had someone you thought was a friend betray you, you know a little bit about how Jesus is feeling in these moments. When verse 22 says his disciples stared at one another at a loss to know which of them he meant. One of them, the disciple whom Jesus loved, was reclining next to him. Simon Peter motioned to this disciple and said, "Ask him which one of us he means." Jesus, he knew who was going to betray him, but his disciples were completely clueless about this. He had told them before, on more than one occasion, that one of them was going to betray him, all the way back in John chapter 6. He told them that one of them would betray him, but they had not really paid any attention to him up until now. Now, all of a sudden, this time, they hear his words, and they're shocked at the possibility that one of them could do such a thing. So Peter, he asked the disciple whom Jesus loved, who is John, the very one who wrote this gospel. This is how John refers to himself in his gospel. The disciple whom Jesus loved. He asked John, who is sitting next to Jesus at the time, he says, "Ask him who it is." And so John goes, "Hey, Jesus, who is it?" And in verse 25, it says, leaning back against Jesus, he asked, "Lord, who is it?" And Jesus answered, "It is the one to whom I will give this piece of bread when I have dipped it in the dish." Then dipping the piece of bread, he gave it to Judas Iscariot, son of Simon. As soon as Judas took the bread, Satan entered into him. "What you are about to do, do quickly," Jesus told him. But no one at the meal understood why Jesus said this to him. Since Judas had charge of the money, some thought Jesus was telling him to buy what was needed for the feast or to give something to the poor. As soon as Judas had taken the bread, he went out, and it was night. The disciples didn't understand who Jesus was referring to even after Jesus told them how they could know who it was going to be. He said, "It is the one that I give this piece of bread to." But even afterwards, they didn't connect the dots. The reason is because the gesture that Jesus makes here is something that meant something different to them. You see, this was something that would be done oftentimes. There was a common pot of food that was in the middle that everyone dipped into with their bread as they were eating. And it was not uncommon for the one who was the head of the meal, who would be Jesus in this case, to take a piece of bread and dip it into the pot and pick out that choicest of morsels, that piece of meat that everyone had their eye on. You know, happens in our meal too, doesn't it? I wonder who's going to grab that big, fat, juicy one right there. And Jesus gets the big, fat, juicy one, and he hands it to Judas. And this was something that you would do to honor someone, to treat them special, to show a special expression of love to them at the meal. So the disciples, they just think Judas got the hookup. And then he goes out on an errand. An errand indeed. Well, Jesus is now left with the other 11 disciples. And in verse 31, it says, "When he was gone, Jesus said, 'Now is the Son of Man glorified, and God is glorified in him. If God is glorified in him, God will glorify the Son in himself and will glorify him at once.'" We've talked before about this. We've seen this before, that Jesus refers to his crucifixion as the moment he's glorified. Why is what many would consider his moment of utter defeat and loss and humiliation considered his moment of glory? And not only his glory, but his Father's glory. I mean, how can that be? Because the crucifixion, the death of Jesus Christ, would be the ultimate expression of the Son's obedience to the Father, giving his very life unselfishly for the sake of lost humanity. See, God is glorified in our obedience, not our accomplishments. Let me say that one more time. God is glorified through our obedience, not through our accomplishments. Now, I want us to think about that for a moment. You see, our natural inclination is to think that if we can accomplish some great thing for the Lord, that it will bring him glory. But he doesn't need our accomplishments. I mean, he can do all that stuff himself better than you and I can do it, can't he? He goes, look, Lord, what I've done for you. He goes, yeah, that's really cool, Jeff. I could have done that faster, quicker, better, more perfect. The thing that he can't do is have you and I willingly obey him out of love for him. You see, that is the one gift that we can give him that is uniquely ours to give, our love and obedience to him. He doesn't need our accomplishment. He is seeking our love, our worship, our obedience. Jesus said, if you love me, you will obey me. In other words, you express your love for me through your obedience to me. And your obedience to me expresses your love for me. Your obedience expresses your trust in me, your confidence in me. The most sincere and pure expression of love that we can give to God is our obedience. Our accomplishments glorify ourselves. My achievements are just that, my achievements. But my obedience is pure, sincere, honest, genuine expression of my love for the Lord. And the perfect obedience of Jesus to the will of the Father, even to the point of giving up his life, set the whole created order back on its heels in wonder, glorifying God. The whole creation stands with its mouth gaping open as it watches the Son obey the Father to the very utter end, giving up his life to those who don't deserve it, but whom the Father asked him to do. His crucifixion is indeed his glory. And the glory of the Father. Because he has done something that no one in the spiritual or physical realm could have ever done other than him. Verse 33, he says, my children, I will be with you only a little longer. You will look for me, and just as I told the Jews, so I tell you now, where I am going, you cannot come. A new command I give you, love one another. As I have loved you, so you must love one another. By this, all men will know that you're my disciples if you love one another. Of all of the things that Jesus might have told his disciples to remember, the thing that he wants them to put at the very top of their list is this: love one another. This is to be the thing that characterizes the followers of Jesus more than anything else. The thing that defines them. The thing that identifies them as his followers, he says. The love they have for each other. This is the thing that we are to be known for. The thing that characterizes the followers of Jesus is not their spiritual giftedness, their theological insight, their missionary work, their evangelism, their fight against poverty, their moral purity. Those things are all good things to pursue, but they are not the thing that is to characterize us. The thing that is to characterize us is our love for each other. The most important thing for us to excel in as followers of Jesus is loving each other. What does Jesus mean when he tells us to love each other? Obviously, he's not talking about a romantic love. He gives us a clue about what he means when he says right here, "As I have loved you, so you must love one another." He goes, "As I've loved you, so are you to love one another." Okay, well, what was that? And John, in his letter of 1 John, he actually answers that for us. 1 John 3:16, he says, "This is how we know what love is. Jesus Christ laid down his life for us. And we ought to lay down our lives for our brothers. If anyone has material possessions and sees his brother in need but has no pity on him, how can the love of God be in him? Dear children, let us not love with words or tongue, but with actions and in truth." A simple thing that Jesus has asked us to do, but also the most difficult thing, isn't it? In closing, I want to close this morning with a little parable of sorts. A parable, you know, is a story from real life that is told that teaches us a spiritual truth through it. The other day, I was in my neighborhood, and I saw a group of guys going down the street, all traveling together, but each was using a different kind of transportation. One of the guys was on a road bike. Another one was on a BMX-type bike. Another was on a skateboard. One was pushing himself with one of those little scooters. And there was one guy who was just walking. They were all on the same path, going to the same destination, but each doing it differently. But they were traveling in such a way that they were doing it together. For example, the guy on the road bike was traveling at such a pace that the guy who was walking could keep up. So they were doing it together. And the thought struck me that this is a picture of the church. They were all traveling together on the same path, going toward the same destination, doing it in such a way they would all make it together. Even though they were each using a different kind of transportation. We don't all ride skateboards. We don't all have to ride skateboards. Some of us are purists. We refuse to use any kind of machinery. We walk. But none of that should be a problem. None of that's important. What's important is that we're traveling together, helping each other, waiting up for each other, carrying each other if needed, making sure we all get to our destination. What's important is that we love one another. Let's bow our heads. Lord, we thank you for the simple but overwhelmingly challenging command that you've given us to love each other. Lord, help us be a people that are defined by our love for one another. The people know we are yours because we love one another. Lord, we want that to be true in us. We need that to be true in us. Make it true in us, Lord. In your name we ask these things, Jesus. Amen.